Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is broadcast number 794. For the past few weeks, I've been going into the narcotics connections of the cocaine cartel in Colombia, the links to the Contras, and to Vice President George Bush. And I promised that I would continue this week with the drug connections to Donald Reagan and Merrill Lynch and E.F. Hutton's office and Scott Pierce, the brother-in-law of George Bush, with E.F. Hutton. But there have been some other matters in the news that lead up to that very point of the very dangerous drug connections they have to the Nazis in South America. So I'm going to put it in a sequential order and get to Merrill Lynch and Donald Reagan, George Bush's family, and E.F. Hutton in probably the end of this week or next week, hopefully. NBC News had an item, well, many broadcasts had on Sunday, February 22nd, how Donald Reagan, the chief of staff, won't leave the White House. The Republicans are demanding that he go, and the guess is that he would go any time from this week until the end of the year. Donald Reagan says, I will not go, and the problem is maintaining the Godfather watching over the White House for very, very good reasons on where this Contragate story can lead. He can't step out now, and he can't stay. He's between a rock and a hard place. Jack Anderson had a column today that personifies the problems going on in Washington for a long, long time since the end of World War II, continuing right now today, and Contragate doesn't interfere with those efforts or goals or the roles of people such as Frank Carlucci, the National Security Advisor. What Jack Anderson has in the paper today is that National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci secretly asked Texas billionaire H. Ross Perot, who works with Oliver North and the Contragate team, to drop his investigation of a top Pentagon official with his links to organized crime, with a lot of links to organized crime. He asked that this be stopped. Now, President Reagan and Mrs. Reagan asked Mr. Perot to look into the investigation of Richard Armitage, the Assistant Defense Secretary. They allegedly want to stop the drug connections, and the Secretary of Defense, the role that Mr. Carlucci once had, is filled by somebody who was named on the President's Crime Commission, the Commission on Organized Crime, of having relationships to somebody involved in narcotics traffic with high-level organized crime figures in Washington, D.C., a gambling operation, and so forth. This is a Vietnamese woman who also probably fronts for a lot of people right on behind her. Ross Perot met with Carlucci, according to Jack Anderson, and he asked Perot to call off the investigation and that he didn't want him to investigate Armitage. And Armitage is named as one of the few people who knew about the Iran arms deals before it was long disclosed, probably long before. And I'm sure that Israel, Iran, and the United States, I know they are heavily involved in narcotics traffic in the area of through Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan is rich with narcotics. This keeps the armies going. Jack Anderson said Ross Perot began checking into Armitage's connections with Nigyet Oruk, I may not be pronouncing her name right, after it was revealed by the President's Commission on Organized Crime that they interrogated Armitage for his relationship to Oruk and also because he's involved in the Iran-Contra stories and works with those very people through the Defense Department. At Perot's request, Jack Anderson furnished documents concerning Armitage's relationship with Oruk. Ross Perot subsequently told Vice President George Bush and high administration officials that his conduct was inappropriate for someone in a sensitive Defense Department position, and Carlucci said, butt off and don't investigate Armitage, the Defense Department, and the organized crime figures in Washington, D.C., which, of course, go other places besides just Washington, D.C. Now, I mentioned on World Watchers a few weeks back, January the 9th, 1987, an article by Jonathan Quitney on Frank Carlucci, Eric von Marburg, Thomas Kleins, General Richard Secord, and Edwin Wilson, and the connection of these persons with Frank Carlucci. And now Secord, Kleins are defendants with many other good people. It's a lawsuit at the Christic Institute. Albert Hakim is also a defendant in that group. And the very people that Frank Carlucci works with in the past and works with today come out of TCI, out in California that became Stanford Technology, with close links to Autobahn Bolschwing, the Galen operation, and the Odessa, Helene Von Damm, General Secord, CIA Thomas Kleins, and Mr. Eric von Marburg. Now, when they were being investigated for making millions of dollars at the taxpayers' money, stealing our money by skimming off the top of arms to Egypt, the Justice Department started to investigate that 3 years ago, Secord and von Marburg. And Michael Ledeen was one of the people that interfered with the investigation, who worked with them in Iran and also in the Contragate area. And Frank Carlucci of the Defense Department stepped in and said, don't prosecute them. As Deputy Defense Secretary in 1982, he overruled the Pentagon's investigation of Secord and von Marburg. And then when he left the Defense Department, he took von Marburg with him. They had very close ties, and he was Pentagon's chief arms sales official. He resigned and went with Carlucci. When Carlucci left the Defense Department for Sears, World Roebuck and Company, their World Trade Organization, and von Marburg started getting $200,000 a year as a consultant, and he's very prosperous now, lives in Belgium, works for the LTV Corporation with, of course, their contracts, the United States. So Carlucci interfered into the skimming off of millions of dollars by persons involved with death squads, organized crime, gun running. They're defendants in a suit for, von Marburg isn't in the Christic Institute suit, but the others are Mr. Thomas Kleins and General Secord, and they are charged with gun running, assassinations, and narcotics traffic. So Carlucci in 1987 as the National Security Advisor is doing what he was doing way back when, in 1982, interfering with the prosecution of these people. Now, there was a very important newscast simultaneously with a printed article in the San Jose Mercury. The newscast came over CNN February the 20th, 1987. It came out of Mendoza, Argentina. I called Atlanta, Georgia, and checked with CNN, and after reaching the editor's desk, the boardroom, the foreign desk, the newsroom desk, and the assignment desk, I got the producer, and he read me the news story as it was on the air on CNN early morning hours, February the 20th. It came out of Mendoza, Argentina. It said a businessman said that Adolf Hitler died 1 month ago in January 1987. He didn't die in the Berlin bunker at the end of World War II. Max Grigorczyk said that Eva Braun, Hitler's mistress until the night they left the bunker and they were married then, is still alive. He can produce proof. He wants a healthy fee, but that's probably to change his identity and get out of Argentina. Grigorczyk said that a friend of his, Juan Aguilera, could back up the proof. They have evidence of paintings that Hitler did recently and while he lived in Argentina. The burial of Adolf Hitler is in a cemetery in Palmiro, 30 miles east of Mendoza in Argentina. Now, the very same day that this came over the air, early morning, CNN, the San Jose Mercury had a front page picture, a little picture of Adolf Hitler, titled, Was the Body Hitler's? A Canadian dental expert says there is new evidence that the body that was found in 1945 was not the Nazi Führer's. And inside there's a long article, Was the Body Hitler's? Well, San Jose Mercury had a picture of Hitler and this same kind of a article, not all about Hitler, but about other matters, in the magazine section when I was interviewed and said Adolf Hitler is still alive, and that was 3 years ago. The story this time comes from the San Jose Mercury and Byline San Diego by Glenna Chu. A Canadian dental expert was speaking to a group of Americans, a scientific group that were meeting in Canada. Presentation just last week. The doctor is Dr. Robert Dorian of Montreal, and he concluded that the body found in the Berlin bunker was not Adolf Hitler's, that the teeth don't match the teeth in the corpse that were identified, that he's been studying this for 2 years. Dorian, director of forensic dentistry for the Minister of Solicitor General of Quebec, presented his findings at a conference of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. It's interesting that the Americans were up there hearing about the life of Adolf Hitler when Reinhard Galen and the group from the Defense Department have known this all along. I'm sure that they have known this for many reasons. I believe they've known this, but now they're being told this story up in Canada, not in the United States. Dr. Dorian's research was conducted over 2 years to throw a new light on the enduring mystery of the last days of the Reich. This author refers to the enduring mystery. When I say it's a mystery, most people say you're out of your mind, Hitler is dead, and they don't even entertain the fact that it is a mystery. According to some accounts, Hitler and his mistress commit suicide in the bunker. However, the Soviet military officials, who were the first to arrive at the bunker, said that Hitler may have escaped. There was an escape route, a secret tunnel that led from the personal room to an underground trolley line. The mystery grew in 1968 when a Soviet journalist published a book saying that the Soviets examined the body of Hitler, claimed it was Hitler, based on conclusions and interviews with Hitler's dentist, who described the work done in Hitler's mouth. After the autopsy, the remains were incinerated and scattered. The book has photographs of the corpse's teeth and bridge work, and also details from the dentist about Hitler's teeth, but these were the inconsistencies that Dr. Dorian has studied. One, two lower bridges found in the corpse that are not visible in photographs taken of Hitler. The Hitler's dentist said, and when questioned by the American officials, never did mention installing any bridges at all, and two bridges were found with the corpse, and not seen in pictures, but they were found with the corpse, and the dentist said he never put in bridges. He remembered every single detail of the upper mouth and bridge, not a single thing about the lowers. Two, the dentist said he had performed a root canal in a certain tooth in the corpse. It was a natural, untouched tooth. There was no evidence of a root canal. Three, the dental assistant said one of Hitler's right teeth was porcelain. In the corpse, it showed that this tooth, whoever it was a natural tooth. And finally, the pattern of gaps between Hitler's teeth does not match the corpse's teeth, according to the way they were drawn out by the dentist and what was seen on the body and then with the pictures of Hitler later. Lester Luntz, a Connecticut dentist who's been investigating Hitler's purported death, now there's a question about it and a mystery, for nearly 20 years said he's convinced that the body in the bunker was not that of the Fuhrer. And this is the latest, February the 20th, 1987. Now, in World Watchers program in 1981, I discussed interviews and research done to show that Hitler's mistress may have escaped the Berlin bunker. That was admitted first, and these gentlemen in Argentina say that she is still alive. From London, new dental evidence uncovered by a California research team strongly suggests that the woman found next to Adolf Hitler was not his mistress, Eva Braun. This was reported in the British Medical Journal. The findings indicate Ms. Braun was buried elsewhere, may even have escaped alive. Imagine that, the British Medical Association News Review said. Soviet soldiers who captured the German capital in the spring came upon 13 bodies near the bunker, and they cited autopsy reports to prove the body of Hitler and Miss Braun were among them. But the British Medical Journal said after 10-year study of World War II, the records revealed that the Soviet evidence on Hitler matches the Nazi leader's known dental records. This is on Adolf Hitler. And there were 28 or 26 separate points, including a unique window crown on one tooth and bridge work in Hitler's lower right jaw. And now it turns out that what they identified as Hitler's wasn't true at all. He didn't have this bridge work in his lower jaw. And in the interrogation of the dentist, that's now been made available, there was no such thing on the jaw, and this was in the autopsy report. The odontological data virtually eliminates the previous assumption that Eva Braun was buried. They assumed she was. There was evidence that a dental bridge for Miss Braun used to link her corpse with Hitler's had in reality never been installed in her mouth. Several teeth found with the body showed extensive cavities. Miss Braun's dental record showed the same teeth cavity free. It claimed that there were two cosmetic Hollywood crowns made of fireproof porcelain that should have been found on the body but weren't. The Medical Journal said the woman whose remains were found in the Soviets had suffered extensive shrapnel wounds and hemorrhaging. Miss Braun was told, or believed by many, to have committed suicide by taking poison. Ryder Sonnier, Sonnaes, who moved to UCLA, a professor of oral biology and anatomy at the University of California at Los Angeles, said the Russian identification of Miss Braun would never stand up in court. Is it possible that Eva Braun escaped? After all, there were a number of men in the bunker unaccounted for who could have helped her. Nobody actually witnessed her death. There are inconsistencies in the account of those who took Eva's body out of the bunker. Hitler's final hours were documented by aides who were with him, including Martin Bormann, on April the 30th, 1945. Now, Martin Bormann escaped and spent 2 years taking all of Hitler's papers and records out of the country. There's every reason to believe, of course, that he did escape with Hans-Ulrich Rudel, his top pilot, who was flying all of their papers down to Argentina for 2 years before the war was over. The article from London says an autopsy was conducted May 18, 1945, at a military hospital in a Berlin suburb. On the basis of that autopsy, they said Hitler and Miss Braun had died. But being done in a Berlin suburb, the Führer could easily escape, and those people would be anxious to say that they died. The British Medical Association reviewed the information, obtained handwritten report of the dental technician, Fritz Eichmann, testifying that the gold bridge with four teeth he made for Miss Braun never was installed. There was no time, and this led to researchers to the dental assistant, Kathy Kuzerman, who is now in her 50s, living quietly in West Germany, who confirmed and filled in details of Miss Braun's dental history. So just this week, Adolf Hitler is presented through dental records as having lived, and at the same time this week, the evidence comes out. Hitler died conveniently a month ago at the age of 98, and if you think it's impossible to live till 98, turn on Today's Show, NBC, every day from 7 to 9 a.m. on the West Coast, and see Willard Scott showing pictures and happy birthday to people 100 years and older. Evidently, Adolf didn't make it. Now, I also had on the air a few years ago connections to the Nazi network that these people carefully set up, and a lot of the information I had regarded Errol Flynn because of his work with Ronald Reagan at a very crucial period, and I took it from Charles Higham's book, Errol Flynn, The Untold Story. And for new listeners, I just want to review this because of the importance of Ronald Reagan's going to Bitburg, of his hiring a member of the Hitler Youth to replace Mr. Buchanan to write his speeches, and now the push for Adolf Hitler's agent, Rudolf Hess, to be released from Spandau Prison by Ronald Reagan in the spring of this year. Reagan's links to these Nazis is not coincidental. His secretary for 8 years in California, Helene von Damm, worked for Otto von Bolschwing out of the Reinhardt-Gehlen network, a top agent of the Waffen-SS, and then she went on to make appointments for Reagan for his 2 periods as president, and after the second election, making appointments, she then went to Vienna and married, as the ambassador of Vienna, married a wealthy man in Vienna, and is back at home in the city where all of this began in the first place. In The Untold Story by Charles Higham, he tells about the movie Santa Fe Trail Ronald Reagan made with Errol Flynn, and then in 1942, Desperate Journey Ronald Reagan made with Errol Flynn. Now, can you be tainted by co-starring in two movies while Errol Flynn is going on and doing his dirty work? That alone doesn't taint you, but everything Ronald Reagan did for the House hearings on the actors, the equivalent of the Senator Joe McCarthy hearings, blacklisting, having people blacklisted and deprived of jobs in Hollywood, and his work working from General Electric up to hiring Helene von Damm and working with top Nazis in California and then in Washington, his career has been simpatico and along the lines that Errol Flynn would have continued if he were alive, but they had these very crucial years together. In between these two pictures, Errol Flynn was going to Mexico frequently. The FBI was trailing him. They had a list of people he met with, the heads of the Nazi Gestapo and the Abwehr, the German intelligence. There were 700 Nazi agents in Mexico City when Flynn was down there, and it was a headquarters from Nazis from the U.S., Japan, Central America, and Spain, waiting for the Axis to make a conquest of Mexico. Errol Flynn visited George Nicholas, the Nazi party chief, and Hans Hellermann, the Gestapo contacts of Dr. Urban. And in the Bahamas, he was meeting with Axel Wenner Grant. Grant is the head of the Electrolux firm. Grant set up the networks in South America with Rudolf Hess to take all of South America and turn it Nazi, then move to Central America and take America in that route. That was the way they were to go. Hess laying out the framework for years since the 30s. To make all of South America Nazi, Central America, and then America, simultaneously working with the Grand Mufti in Jerusalem, making all the Middle East and Africa, the northern part of Africa, and the Arab countries Nazi, to take the Mediterranean and push it from that end, these people working together. Errol Flynn was down in the Bahamas with Axel Wenner Grant, at that time referred to as the richest man in the world, who was the munition maker for Adolf Hitler, supplying Hitler, making weapons through his good friend Hermann Göring, and arms were shipped continuously to Norway from Axel Wenner Grant's headquarters. He was above international law, and in Charles Higham's book, Errol Flynn, The Untold Story, he tells about Axel Wenner Grant, the Nazi munitions maker who introduced Errol Flynn to the Canadian Sir Harry Oakes and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. And, of course, the Harry Oakes story is very, very important to this. Now, the link of these persons goes on continuously right to Francois Junot. I won't have time to do a lot of them on him this weekend, but he's the top Nazi in Switzerland who funds the accounts of Adolf Hitler, or Hitler until last month, and the Göring family, and Martin Bormann. He's the banker that lives in Switzerland. He attended the meetings where the Nazis went underground with Martin Bormann there, and Bormann was one of the last people in the bunker when Hitler allegedly left, and they planned their removal very, very carefully, years ahead, 2 years ahead. And so the links of Junot in Switzerland now, he's funding Jacques Vergès, the attorney for Klaus Barbie, for his trial. Well, this is the fourth year now that he's sitting in prison. And he's also funding the trial for the terrorist of direct action, Mr. Abdullah, who is being tried starting this week. Junot, the Nazi, funds the left Arab connections, the Grand Mufti connections, and the terrorist organizations, as well as the far right, the left-right merge, and I want to do more on the left-right continuously. I've done some before, and it's very important. But Francois Junot, the money man for the trial of the terrorist in Paris right now, the money man for paying Jacques Vergès to represent both Klaus Barbie and Mr. Abdullah in Paris, comes from Junot, who worked and works with Martin Bormann and Joseph Mengele and has had the rights to all of Adolf Hitler's material up to and through whatever time it takes, I guess, for the rest of Hitler's memory, any books that come out that were left from Hitler after the war. There's an article, quite a few articles, on the jewelry of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, part of this team with Axel Wenner Grant and Errol Flynn, and the Gestapo and Rudolf Hess, and they left all of their jewelry to the charity, the Pasteur Clinic, that Pasteur Institute, a French biological research organization, and their scientists are the ones that have been working for the disease, or supposedly to find a vaccine to defeat AIDS. Now, the vaccine they want is to protect those people that are meant to live and immune them, give them immunization, and the others won't have access to it, just as the Fort Detrick's Maryland scientists and the Pasteur Clinic work on creating a cure for certain diseases before they spread it among the masses, so that in case it escapes, they themselves have the cure. The Pasteur Clinic and the United States are active in Zaire, which has a large amount of AIDS, and in Africa, and the money from the jewelry from the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, after leaving the scene of the Gestapo and Rudolf Hess and Göring and Axel Wenner Grant, is to leave approximately $7 million in jewelry that will go to AIDS, that will be in the hands of persons at the Pasteur Clinic with a track record that is really fearful. Now, there have been articles that emerge from time to time, and now they're heating up now, that Ronald Reagan is urged to escort Hess out of prison. A friend sent me this from the Oregonian, January the 31st, 1987. Leaders of a group of German Americans urged President Reagan on Thursday to go to West Berlin and personally escort Rudolf Hess, the last surviving major war criminal, out of Spandau prison. First of all, Joseph Mengele is alive. Second, Martin Bormann is alive. He's not the last surviving, but Rudolf Hess. And I don't believe it for a minute, this is the Rudolf Hess that is there, the genius between South America, Central America, and Nazism and corporate combinations in this country. I don't believe that's him, but it would be symbolic for Hess living in South America or Switzerland to see somebody escort that poor dog out of the prison, meaning we give approval to you now and we're not looking at you as a war criminal anymore. This request for Reagan goes to a visit coming up in West Berlin in June of this year, and Hess is held by the United States, the French, the British, and the Soviets, and Stan Rittenhouse, president of the German-American Information and Education Association, said, "All Mr. Reagan needs to do is visit Mr. Hess when it is America's turn to guard him and tell this harmless old man of 92, I'm going to make you a free man." Now, it is the symbolism of Ronald Reagan going there that is important for the world to see, just as is putting a wreath on the graves of the Waffen SS. It is the symbolism that Reagan works with, telling them it's okay and kosher now. Come on, Mr. Hess. And the man isn't going to say anything that anyone will recognize because it hasn't been Hess for a long, long time. Now, Phyllis Schlafly, the woman behind Ronald Reagan's entire career with Patrick Frawley of the John Birch Society, has written an article January 29th. It was in the Washington Times. Memoirs going up in smoke. It isn't clear which of the three superpowers continues to impose on Rudolf Hess's history's most famous protracted case of solitary confinement and isolation. We urge Ronald Reagan to release Hess, He took an airplane, and this is important, May the 10th, 1941, and he landed in the backyard of the Duke of Hamilton. He landed in the darkness on the property of the Duke of Hamilton, and the pilot was Rudolf Hess, and he came asking Great Britain to assist Germany to fight Russia at that time. We hadn't even declared war against Germany when Rudolf Hess flew over to England, so it's interesting that he's been locked up all this time. Now, what Phyllis Schlafly is saying, we don't want the memoirs to go up in the smoke, but on the other hand, she admits that Hess writes his memoirs. He writes them every day. He completes a section every month. It's taken from the guards, and it's burned without his knowledge, but the whole world knows it. So you don't know what he wrote, and you may just be writing on how to grow nasturtiums and not anything about Rudolf Hess's experiences, and that's why it has to be burned. She says, save this history, but the history has been burned for over 40 years. She does admit that his court-appointed lawyer has never been allowed to speak to him of his trial or sentence. This is exactly the way Vance Cooper was treated when he was put in place of Howard Hughes and carried around various countries. And it wasn't Howard Hughes at all. This man was drugged and kept in a stupor and compared to a victim of a Nazi concentration camp. Robert Mayhew never saw Howard Hughes. Chester Davis never saw Howard Hughes. The top persons of the Summa Corporation never saw Howard Hughes. Paul Laxalt in Vegas as governor never saw Howard Hughes. And the court-appointed lawyer for Hess never saw Hess. Amnesty International, the Red Cross, are not permitted to visit him. When he dies, he will be cremated immediately. Any doctor who saw him said the rib cages were entirely different than the ribs wounds of Rudolf Hess from World War I. His ashes will be scattered. They can't be given to the family. And what Phyllis Schlafly doesn't say is that Spandau Prison is all set to be detonated. They're going to destroy and bomb the entire place where he is. She claims that, wouldn't you think now that we would let him out? But what Phyllis Schlafly is saying, and she's worked with these Nazis, neo-Nazis, old Nazis, tired Nazis, young Nazis, and the Knights of Malta, what she's saying is, let the symbolism, let the President of the United States go get Hess out. And it's like saying at Bitburg, we approve of you, Mr. Hess. You were right. The Russians are bad. Come with us. In all these years, 40 years, first 10 years, he couldn't see his family. And I mentioned this before in broadcast. Then no member of the family can touch him. No member of the family can record anything he says. And he walks around with a guard there all the time, lights on all the time, and they can't even feel his hands to know whether he has the same touch as the father, as the husband, and so forth. Family are living. And for 10 years, they didn't see him at all. So while they caged in this symbol, the network was set up for the Odessa to take the United States, to take over the world. These various countries, and with the exception of about 5 or 10, they have it all now. And now they want all the dressings, the wrappings. And this is why it's important to take heed, the CNN broadcast was on the 20th. This is the 24th. There isn't a thing so far in the news other than the San Jose Mercury story, or the 23rd, rather, about the story of Hitler in Argentina, even though many, many people know throughout the world that Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun did not die in the bunker, and the effect of what they did is what we're feeling. The flight capital out of this country, the farms closing, the pollution. The network is perfect. It worked. And he's 98. He could die, and he could rest in peace, because everything he wanted is just about here. We'll take a one-minute break and continue on the story of Hess, Henry Kissinger, Fritz Kramer, and the importance of this story that Hitler only died 1 month ago.